still mourning, our last hurrah. Can you hear well enough from this microphone in the back? Can you raise your hand if you can? How about if I speak a little more directly in it? Okay, if the peas start popping, you'll put your hand up, okay? My name is Judy Auerbach. I coordinate the behavioral and social science activities in the Office of AIDS Research at the National Institutes of Health. And I've been asked to stand in as moderator for this very important panel. So I'm going to dispense with any introductory remarks and move right along to our important speakers. As you are hopefully fully aware, this is a panel that is going to be talking about defining a national AIDS policy, research, health services, and prevention. And we'll have four talks addressing research, prevention, healthcare services, and community organizations. We've had a couple of substitutions, including myself, obviously. So we're all being very flexible here. I will do only very brief introductions of people and hope that they will add additional information in their presentations. What we'd like to do is let each of the speakers have their full allotted time, and at the end take questions and open for discussion. If we run out of time, because there are a couple of limitations at the end of the session, then I think as many as possible of the speakers will stay around for further discussion as can. Ready? Okay, we're going to proceed in the order listed, except with there's one substitution. The first speaker is Maxine Wolf, who I think probably most of you know. And I'm going to do an abbreviated introduction here. Maxine Wolf has been a women's health activist for over 25 years and has focused specifically on HIV/AIDS issues since 1987 when she co-founded the Women's Committee of the AIDS of ACT UP. We all know what the acronym is. She also founded the ACT UP National Women's Network. She has worked very directly with or against or for or in the face of government to help change the AIDS definition used by the CDC to include infections specific to women and drug users. And she's been instrumental in getting the government to do a number of things, including having the first national conference on women with HIV and AIDS, forming a women's health committee at the AIDS Clinical Trials Group, and creating and funding the Women's HIV Study, and also to meet with lesbians with HIV and AIDS to discuss their specific issues. She's written and presented on numerous occasions, and I will move right along to introduce Maxine. Thank you.
Thanks. I'd like to dedicate this talk to Mary Lucy, whose greatest asset and probably her greatest fault as well is that she always feels like she's responsible not only for her own health, but for the health of every other woman in the world living with HIV, and my health too. And I love you, Mary. And also to all the women who joined in the protests in the press conference this week and had the courage to stand up and speak out and tell the truth. I really salute all of you. Thanks. To find a location for this that doesn't block my eyes. When I was asked to speak about future national research programs, my first thought was, that's easy. Given the current state of knowledge, I would say there's been no coherent policy, and then I would propose one. Then I reconsidered my thought. Let me tell you why. Women account for about 11.9% of participants ever to have been in government-sponsored clinical AIDS clinical trials groups trials, testing the outcomes of anti-HIV treatments or treatments for opportunistic infections. With the exception of one study, even when there have been enough women in research, comparisons of outcomes between men and women have not been done. Most studies don't have enough women to do comparisons. In drug company research, the percent is lower. And while there have been about 1,000 pregnant women in government-sponsored trials to study perinatal transmission, and 13 more trials are planned or just completed, which will include 5,000 more pregnant women, studies of anti-HIV or opportunistic infection treatments exclude pregnant women. We don't know dosing or dose intervals for women, though some data exists for pregnant women. Drug labels do not state whether a drug has been tested in a woman. They do give this information about pregnant women and children. We know how pregnancy influences disease progression, but not how anti-HIV treatments affect infections women get, like cervical cancer or bacterial pneumonia, or how they affect women's renal functioning, liver functioning, or viral load. Measures of drug effectiveness are based on men. We don't know how viral load relates to disease progression in women. We do have some data relating viral load to perinatal transmission. We don't know how treatments for infections like lymphoma or MAC affect women. We know that using fluconazole prevents vaginal yeast infections in women with HIV, but we don't know whether eating yogurt would do the same thing. We don't know about viral concentrations in women's lymph nodes or about long-term non-progressing women. We do know that in 1996, AIDS deaths for women rose while they decreased for men, and survival times are shorter for women. The first cases of HIV were reported in 1981. After 16 years, I had to ask myself, why do we know so little? This led me to reconsider that first thought. I believe there is a national research policy, but much of it is unspoken. It reflects a set of ideas in general and about women living with HIV/AIDS in particular that seem so natural that even when spoken, they are accepted as true without thinking. Changing them is not going to be easy. But if we want an ethical national research policy which might extend or save women's lives, we are going to have to create it based on a whole different set of ideas. Could I have the first overhead? I call the ideas which now exist the faulty foundations of current research policies. They're in the left column. As I talk about them, you can look at the ones in the right-hand column, which I call the building blocks for an ethical research policy. That is what a different set of ideas would be. After I go over these, I want to propose some first steps towards a new policy. Numbers 1 to 5 on the left are explanations given for why women were and are not in clinical or basic research, why so little women-focused research exists, and why we know so little. Numbers 1 to 3 were spoken until about 1990. We have disproved them, but they still influence in unspoken form what is being done now. The MAC study following 6,000 infected men but no women was federally funded and began in 1993. Almost everything we know about disease progression and immune system functioning comes from that study. But researchers were denied federal funding to study women. The government, the medical research establishment, and drug companies acted like women with HIV/AIDS did not exist. Women AIDS activists documented the exclusion of women from research and demanded inclusion. Around 1987, some people had to admit that women with HIV existed, but said there were too few to be included in clinical research. Dosing studies have as few as 5 or 10 participants, we said. Women are almost totally absent from this phase, which assesses pharmacokinetics, how drugs are absorbed and cleared by the body, which influences toxicity, dosing, safety, and effectiveness. Confronted with this response, another reason suddenly appeared. Most women were in the early stages of infection, not getting infections for treatments being studied, and with CD4 counts too high to be taking anti-HIV medications. Until recently, the largest number of women in a trial for an antiretroviral, 299 women, were an ACTG 019 in the late 1980s, studying AZT in asymptomatics. However, we don't know if the women really were asymptomatic. They simply did not have male-defined symptoms, and the data were not analyzed by gender anyway. So women AIDS activists did the research and produced the first women's treatment and research agenda in 1990, in which we discussed TB, vaginal candidiasis, cervical cancer, MAC, bacterial pneumonia, and more. We pressured the government to form a women's health committee at the ACTGs, which happened in 1990, and to do a natural history study of women comparable to the MAC. The WISE was finally funded in 91 and it began in 93. We pressured the CDC to add women's infections to the definition of AIDS and its HIV symptoms because numbers of cases based on those definitions were used to decide what should be studied, and because almost all clinical research required a CDC definition of AIDS or an HIV symptom as an entry criteria. The CDC capitulated in 1993, also adding less than 200 CD4s as an AIDS definer. In the following half year, over 9,000 cases in women were reported, an increase of 34% over the cumulative total up to that time. And in 1996, of 13,820 cases in women, 64.5% fit only the 1993 definition. However, although we have proved that lots of women with HIV/AIDS are in various stages of illness, we still have not seen large numbers of women in clinical or basic science research. We have not seen gender analysis, women-specific studies, or women-specific measures of the effectiveness of drugs. No government-funded research team is required to have a women's health specialist. On the Women's Health Committee, obstetricians and pediatricians dominate. The ACTG Oncology Committee does not want to study cancers women get. At conferences, as we have seen, information is being presented about treatment outcomes or relating immune function to progression based on studies with men, although this is hardly ever stated. When we finally ask, is this data based on women, presenters panic. They can't even give us this information. Ideas 1 to 3 still influence the research. When we raise these issues, we are told 4, women don't want to participate in research. Women do have a healthy suspicion about medical research based on experience and information. The Tuskegee syphilis studies are often cited as reasons why African American women don't want to participate, but we rarely hear about the experiences of poor women, especially Puerto Rican and other Latina women, who have had doctors coercing them into sterilization in exchange for abortion, or how the FDA approved research which also produced DES and the Dalcon Shield. But still, most of women's lack of participation is not of their own choosing. There are lots of ways women are excluded from drug research. For example, trials exclude former or present drug users. But even if women enter research, they are likely to drop out because they are treated as subjects, not participants. They are not given information about the data being collected from them, nor receiving state-of-the-art primary care, when these may be the reasons why they agreed to participate, since it's their only access to both of these things. In the WISE, most participants were not given their viral load data until recently, and at one site, the reason given was that the women would get too panicked if they saw the big numbers and tried to, and all they knew about was CD4 cells. The newspapers are talking about viral loads in lymph nodes, but the work is not being done in that study, nor has it produced data on treatments and progression, on viral load and progression, or even the causes of death for the women who were participants. Yet recently they decided to do a study of the children of those dead women. The dropout rate is incredibly high. Miraculously, there have been some women who met the study criteria for drugs and were desperate to enter a trial in order to access an experimental therapy, only to be told that they would have to be surgically sterilized. This points to a major reason for women's exclusion from drug research. The Food and Drug Administration guidelines and regulations for clinical research, which are based on several other ideas about women, ideas shared by researchers and used by drug companies to continue business as usual. One idea is number 5. Women living with HIV/AIDS are not capable of making decisions about their own lives and are in need of protection. The 1977 FDA guidelines excluded women of, quote, childbearing potential from phase 1 studies and from later studies as well, unless animal fetal toxicity and reproductive studies were completed. A woman of, quote, childbearing potential was defined as a menstruating woman capable of becoming pregnant, even if she used birth control, the major age group of women living with HIV/AIDS. Entry criteria for research trials still can and do exclude women of, quote, childbearing potential. Researchers, drug companies, and the FDA claimed they were protecting women and potential fetuses, but they were and are willing to put women and real fetuses at risk in perinatal transmission studies, while excluding these very same pregnant women from studies of treatments for themselves. And more women are at risk taking drugs tested on men and not labeled as such. Lack of concern for the fetus and the sexist bias is clear because men of, quote, childbearing potential are not excluded nor required to be sterilized, even when there are known effects on fetuses if a man's sperm has been exposed to a toxic substance. After more demonstrations by women AIDS activists, the filing of a citizen's petition charging the FDA with sex discrimination, in 1993, the FDA issued a set of guidelines about how and why to do gender analysis in clinical trials. Admitting that the 1977 guidelines were paternalistic, unnecessary, and put women's lives at risk, all these new guidelines did was to, quote, lift the strict limitation on, quote, women of childbearing potential, and, quote, encourage drug companies to include them. But they did not require the inclusion of women in research, nor did they require the presentation of data about women for the approval of a new drug. The FDA admitted that these guidelines would not increase the number of women in trials. These guidelines contained other ideas about women which signal a continuation of business as usual, 6, 7, and 8. The first is that women are only a subgroup of the population. Guess who the population is? In practice, this statistical term means that sometimes the group is put into trials, but only in small numbers, unless you have reason to believe you will find differences. Small differences mean no meaningful or statistical analysis of data, so you never find differences. Then you have no reason to believe you will find differences, and the circle continues. For instance, Vyrasept from Agaron was approved about 1 month ago under these guidelines based on a study of 33 women and 1,000 men. They claimed there were no differences. After more protests, critiques, letter writing campaigns, and in 1994, a protest at the FDA and at the National Drug Development Task Force meetings, in September 1995, the FDA put out for public comment proposed amendments to the investigational new drug and new drug approval regulations. These have still not been issued 1.5 years later. But even if they were, they would hardly change the situation. They use the word require, and they would be regulations instead of guidelines, but all they require is, one, a drug sponsor who gets approval to investigate a new drug has to provide a yearly report giving the number of people entered by age, race, and gender. But dosing studies last far less than a year, so all we're going to get is more proof of women being excluded after the fact. Requirement number two is for new drug approvals, which for life-threatening illnesses like AIDS can be submitted during the second of 3 phases of testing. Sponsors must provide, quote, evidence to support dosing recommendations on labels as well as, quote, effectiveness data by age, gender, and racial subgroups. But this regulation also specifically states that it does not require the inclusion of particular numbers of individuals from, you guessed it, subgroups. The sponsors only have to present data already collected. Simply by having a few women or people of color in a study and stating that there do not seem to be differences or they could not be sure, a new drug could still be approved. This may change labeling so that it now says the drug has not been tested in women, but there is no requirement to label the drugs previously approved. As long as women are considered only a subgroup of the population, the lack of information will continue. Comparative trials require enough people in each group to enable analysis. To scare us, we are told that putting enough women in research will delay drug approval. This is not a problem about women. If having enough people to do comparisons will delay things, and I don't think it will, and since the last 150 years of research have been based on male bodies, Perhaps we need women-only studies for the next 150 years. And men can take the drugs tested in our bodies. The response of researchers and male AIDS activists to this suggestion is horror. And I myself believe it would be highly unethical, but so is the opposite. Women as a subgroup reflects two other faulty ideas, 7 and 8, that there are no differences between men and women, and if there are, they are only in areas of reproductive organs and functioning. Women do get cervical cancer, which men don't, but they are also more likely to get bacterial pneumonia or to have renal problems. Estrogen affects drug absorption and clearance. Trials with postmenopausal women or pregnant women eliminate exactly the thing that makes a difference. Some small studies point to the outcomes for infected women. Here are two. A recent Dutch study found that AZT cleared women's bodies 42% slower than men's, and it wasn't due to body weight. Another study found that women taking the same dose of dilavudine as men were getting more absorbed into their bodies. What does this mean for toxicity, for combination therapies, for compliance, for resistance, for effectiveness? We don't know. The studies with women enrolled, which do exist, are based on idea number 9, that women are more likely to transmit HIV to others, babies and men, but not to other women, than to have it transmitted to themselves, even though the opposite is true. Search the medical indexes under women and AIDS. In 1989, most papers were about pregnancy and prostitution, and it remains the same today. We have studies of viral load in cervical vaginal fluid, but not in women's lymph nodes. No one really takes women-to-women sexual transmission seriously, but we have one perinatal transmission study after another. Even though the number of children with AIDS was very low before the use of AZT during pregnancy, about 1/10 the number of women with AIDS. And if you dare to say this, you risk being called a baby hater. But in the absence of research on treatments addressing women's own health and the exclusion of pregnant women from research for treatments for themselves, the focus on perinatal transmission trials as well as that research, the way in which that research is done, reflect idea number 10. All women with HIV/AIDS want to become pregnant or are pregnant and should be willing to give up their health in order to have an uninfected child. The idea of the innocent child and the guilty woman are alive and well in the AIDS medical research establishment. Pregnant women who do not want to take AZT or other drugs are considered criminal by some and ignorant by others. And their health comes last in these studies. Recently, women AIDS activists pointed out that that AZT monotherapy is no longer the standard of care for any infected person and that the perinatal guidelines could be considered medical malpractice. There are now new draft guidelines, but they also give women unacceptable choices based on no information, suggesting that due to lack of data from animal fetal toxicity and reproductive studies, women might consider stopping their combination therapy for the first 14 months of pregnancy. Why didn't the FDA require this information before approving those drugs? These guidelines are not about reproductive choice. Neither are the perinatal trials planned in Thailand, the Ivory Coast, and Uganda for several thousand pregnant women, all of which compare AZT monotherapy to placebo. Even if we don't deal with the AZT monotherapy part of that study, how could the NIH and the CDC knowingly fund research trials which allow women to transmit HIV to their children when they could prevent 2/3 of these cases according to their own research? And given the high cost of all these drugs, who is the research really for? Are women living with HIV/AIDS in other countries expendable? This leads to number 12. When asked why these perinatal trials were using placebos and not comparing AZT to combos, one response was they needed to have a group of high transmitters to show the differences statistically. When researchers do not see women living with HIV/AIDS as human beings, but merely as research subjects, science becomes more important than life. Good science does not have to sacrifice lives. Even if federal agencies, researchers, and others agree that we know little about women, and yes, they hear our anger, and yes, there is room for improvement, they tell us, number 13, there is no money, and number 14, it will take time. There is money for perinatal trials, for the WITS, for the MAC. There is a separate pediatric ACTG, although I don't think their research is any better. The quality of research is an issue. One researcher at an ACTG meeting, seeing my frustration, said, "You want cutting-edge research, but what we do here is mediocre research." We are told that our complaints about the WISE study are unfounded, since it's only been going for 3 years and the MAC study has been going for so long. Yet the WISE study, as it is designed and run, is mediocre research. It is quickly becoming another transmission study, never one of its goals, and it has no state-of-the-art immunology and virology. If you believe that the lives of all people living with HIV/AIDS are equally valuable, put expertise and money into women's lives too, because women living with HIV/AIDS don't have any more time than anyone else to wait. Women can't wait another 10 years for useless or anachronistic information, or for people to care about keeping us alive or why we die. We need to completely refocus our research policy, programs, and funding based on a different set of ideas, the ones that were on the right. Can I have the next chart? Each of you had or were given when you came in a paper with a set of recommendations for ethical national research policy for women living with HIV/AIDS. If you didn't get one and you raise your hand, someone will come around and give them to you, because I'm only going to summarize them, and then you'll take your time to read them. Right now, with no acts of Congress, no changes in regulations, in fact, with only a telephone call or an email, everything on page one could be implemented and move us forward incredibly quickly. Donna Shalala and Sandy Thurman should put their political will and control of money where their mouths are. Give priority to funding AIDS research for women, and get all public health service agency heads who control any research money to have a plan for implementing that within a month. They get told that all the time. The NIH has the power right now to require that all of their funded research include enough women, do gender analysis, use women-specific measures in all studies, and study women's infections, and to mandate women's health specialists on every research team. And if we can't wait for the FDA to force the drug companies to do fetal and reproductive toxicity studies for drugs already approved, the NIH should contract them out and we can get the information within a few months. If the WISE study cannot quickly do state-of-the-art virological and immunological data and relate it to disease progression and treatment, give that part of the study to the MAC, give them a women health specialist, and pay them to do it. And put women living with HIV/AIDS on every single grant review committee.
Yes, indeed.
Knowledgeable women, and if they're not knowledgeable, give them the knowledge. These are the policy changes on page two that the FDA should make. Above all, requiring the inclusion of enough women in clinical trials to do meaningful analysis, and requiring this analysis for drug approval. Force the drug companies to do the animal studies before they can test the drug in people, and then let the women decide, just like men, what they want to do based on that information. Label the drugs accordingly, and put women on the committees that judge whether those drugs should be approved. It is past due time for research about and for women living with HIV/AIDS that is of the highest scientific and ethical quality, which speaks to women's bodies and needs and is designed around women's lives. Women living with HIV/AIDS need research which allows real reproductive choice, but they must not be viewed only as reproductive machines or transmitters to babies and men. If the answer to the question, who is the cure for, is truly to be, it's for everybody, we must not simply ask for these things. We must demand research to save women's lives. Thank you.
passion and precision. She told me it would take 23 minutes. It did. I'd next like to introduce Dr. Wanda Jones from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Jones is Associate Director for Women's Health, and that's all she asked me to say about her, so she'll tell you the rest.
Thank you, Judy.
We've just been informed that there's a film crew that would like to film this session from the back of the room, meaning that for the entire audience, only the back of you will be shown, but for the speakers, the front of us will be shown. So we need to get permission from everyone in order to do that. Is there anyone who deeply objects to that? Where is that film crew going? Channel 9 in Los Angeles? Is it going national? For local coverage? Evidently not.
No.
So is that all right with everyone? Just don't turn around.
Your head.
Put your head
down. Go back to the camera. Thank you. Don't forget.
Don't turn around.
I hate announcements like that. Because it also means you can't leave without being seen, right? Dr. Helene Gale is the director of the National Center for HIV, STD, and TB Prevention. She's disappointed she couldn't be here today to give this talk because she is the focal point for policy around HIV, STD, and TB prevention at the Centers for Disease Control. As you may know, the World Health Assembly is meeting this week and next in Geneva, and that scheduling conflict and the Secretary's insistence has Helene in Geneva with the U.S. delegation briefing the World Health Assembly on various HIV-AIDS activities and issues. For the first time in the history of the HIV epidemic, we've seen a substantial decline in deaths related to HIV and AIDS in this country. In the first quarter of 1996, we saw a 15% decline in AIDS deaths among men when compared to the first quarter of 1995. And while this is an important milestone in the fight against AIDS, women did not share fully in this progress. During the same time period, AIDS deaths among women increased by 3%. The reality that AIDS deaths among women continue to rise and that women are one of the fastest growing populations affected by AIDS clearly underscores and reinforces the need for policies that effectively serve women. Policies that will reverse the trends we're now seeing among women, among populations of women, and in communities of women. Policies that ensure women reap the benefits of AIDS research, treatment, prevention, and care. Today, I'll talk about several key issues I believe are critical in any national AIDS policy that fully integrates women and their needs. I will address risks to women and prevention and research opportunities as they relate to policy. Today, in the United States, it's been estimated that about 120,000 to 160,000 adult and adolescent women are infected with HIV. In just over a decade, the proportion of female adult and adolescent cases has nearly tripled, from 7% of the annual total in 1985 to 20% in 1996. You can do the math. Obviously, the proportion, the distribution of cases among adult and adolescent males had to have declined over this same time period. The picture is particularly distressing when we look at women of color. African American and Hispanic American women comprise less than 1/4 of the U.S. population of U.S. women, but they account for more than 3/4 of AIDS cases among women in this country. For African American women ages 25 to 44, AIDS is the leading cause of death. Well, what are the factors that place women at increased risk for infection? Until recently, injection drug use constituted the greatest risk factor for women in the United States, but this is no longer the case. Injection drug use accounted for about a third of cases of women with AIDS reported in 1996, but 40% of cases with AIDS among women were attributed to sexual contact with an infected man. For 24% of women with AIDS, the risk was not reported or identified, and after further investigation, many of these cases also will be attributed to heterosexual contact. If we look at those cases attributed to heterosexual contact among women, the cases among the women infected heterosexually, I can't even read my own writing, about a third reported having had sex with an injection drug user. An even greater proportion of women with sexually acquired AIDS were infected through sex with an infected partner whose risk was not identified or reported. Many of these women may not have been aware of their partner's status or risk behaviors. Several reports have been published indicating possible female-to-female transmission of HIV. We do believe that this mode of transmission is rare. From studies of HIV prevalence among women attending STD or sexually transmitted disease clinics and women's health clinics, which suggest that HIV infection among women who have sex with women is closely associated with injection drug use or sexual contact with men at increased risk for HIV infection. Additionally, a large population-based study involving nearly 1 million female blood donors found no woman who was infected with HIV through sexual contact with another woman. However, these data do not exclude the possibility of female-to-female transmission. CDC will continue to work with the communities of women who have sex with women to examine behavioral and other risk factors for HIV infection among them. We will continue to examine risk factors for other populations of women as well, for example, among female adolescents and young adults. Among this group, the presence of other STDs may play a key role in HIV incidence. For many years, researchers have recognized that the risk factors of behaviors that put people at risk for STDs are the same ones that put them at risk for sexually transmitted HIV. For women in the United States, the spread of HIV infection through sexual transmission has followed in the footsteps of other STD epidemics. And there is growing biological evidence demonstrating that the presence of other STDs increases the likelihood of both transmitting and acquiring HIV. Evidence from well-designed epidemiological studies. Hold on. Well, it figures remotes don't work with women. It's that damned Y chromosome.
Maybe it needs to stay here.
Will you please advance it for the sake of women? I don't think there's anybody back there, but there's a volunteer jumping up. Let me move on, and we will catch up with the slides. Great. Government official has hang-ups. I can see the press now. Thank you. There we go. Thank you. My hero.
Marilyn,
thank you. Evidence from well-designed epidemiological studies from four continents, including North America, has repeatedly linked the presence of STDs with a 3- to 5-fold increased risk for HIV transmission. This is true for STDs that cause genital ulcers, such as syphilis, herpes, or chancroid, as well as for the non-ulcerative STDs, which include chlamydia, gonorrhea, and trichomoniasis. The link between STDs and HIV presents an important opportunity for HIV prevention, and of course it's reflected in the merger and the establishment of our Center for HIV, STD, and TB Prevention. First of all, STD trends offer important insights into where the HIV epidemic may grow. Planning groups should use STD surveillance data as markers of where HIV rates are likely to increase, especially among women. In addition, STD testing and treatment may significantly reduce the risk of HIV transmission. Programs to prevent sexual transmission of HIV should develop strong linkages with STD testing and treatment programs, and these linkages should also extend to family planning programs. This is especially important for HIV programs that target adolescents and young women who are at increased risk of HIV infection. We know that male latex condoms provide protection against HIV and other STDs, but we also recognize that male condoms are not always an option for women. CDC remains committed. We remain committed to behavioral science that will help women better negotiate condom use with their partners. And the good news is that several presentations at this conference indicate that many women are able to negotiate safer sex and feel empowered to do so. So what we learn from this research needs to be applied in communities across the country. But in addition, CDC, there we go again. Thank you. In addition, CDC remains committed to research that will help identify and evaluate female-controlled methods for protecting against HIV as well as other STDs. To date, the female condom appears to provide the best alternative to the male condom. Clinical data on the effectiveness of the female condom in HIV and STD prevention is limited, and CDC will continue research to determine effectiveness and acceptability. But we're also evaluating the effectiveness, safety, and acceptability of other female-controlled methods to prevent HIV transmission, including topical microbicides. To date, the effectiveness and safety of these products are unknown. Just another word slide. Oh, yeah. Anyway. We know that some studies have shown that